Hi, this is Colin. Please stay tuned after Rabia's interview because Susan and I have a very special interview with Brooke Giddings, the host and creator of the podcast Actual Innocence.
The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com. to place your order and reserve your copy today. Hi, and welcome to another special episode of Undisclosed, Absolutely Innocent. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. Now, last week, we looked at the Stephen Avery case. In it, the state had gathered lots of evidence against Avery, including physical evidence like his own blood in the victim's car. But there were a lot of reasons to doubt the integrity of their evidence, which leads me with a question of how do you know when you can absolutely trust the evidence? After all, over the years, lots of different kinds of evidence that we used to accept readily really have been questioned, whether it is things like bite mark evidence or how hair is forensically tested. You can look at the cell phone evidence that was used in Adnan's case. But if there is one thing that most people will accept as open and shut, that is evidence in the form of a confession. After all, who admits to a crime they didn't commit? This week, we speak to a man who confessed to killing his parents many years ago, and the friend who reconnected with him to help him fight for exoneration many years later. So I want to start by welcoming Professor Mark Howard, who is a professor of government and law at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I met Mark at the Night for Justice Gala that was held in early March. And I think afterwards, Mark, I believe you came and introduced yourself to me. But anyhow, so I want to welcome you to the show and thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
After we met, I looked you up, and I know that you recently, around the same time, had launched a new initiative. So I got really interested in your work, and I see that you mostly teach government. A lot of your publications are about citizenship, government, immigration, things of that sort. But you seem to be much, like, you do have, like, an entire field around criminal justice. So can you tell us about your work in general and then the criminal justice work you've done?
Sure. So basically, my work has followed a trajectory that then took a twist. I was working in the political science field of comparative politics, and I've written several books, as you said, civil society, democracy, citizenship, immigration. But I had this personal backstory, which we'll get into in a little bit, that led to a growing interest in criminal justice. And it actually led me to go to law school as a tenured professor at Georgetown. And I then went on, got a JD, and then my research and teaching interests have really shifted in the direction of criminal justice in prisons. And so now I teach multiple classes that involve prisons. I also teach in a prison in the Jessup Correctional Institution as a volunteer professor, which I've been doing for several years. And also my research has moved in a direction where I'm looking at American criminal justice in prisons in comparative perspective. And I have a book that's coming out at some point in the next year or so called Unusually Cruel: Prisons, Punishment, and the Real American Exceptionalism. So this has become the real focus of my research and my teaching. And I have also directing at Georgetown the Prisons and Justice Initiative, which just launched a few months ago, this spring of 2016. And we've been hosting a number of high-profile events where we've gotten several hundred to attend with really exciting discussions about cutting edge issues involving prison reform.
Can you back up a little bit? I didn't realize that you actually went to law school as a tenured professor. When did that happen? How long ago were you talking about here?
So I started in 2008 and then I finished at the end of 2011. So I did my JD in seven semesters.
Wow.
And I was literally taking law classes on the same days when I was teaching classes. So it would lead to a very schizophrenic existence, an exhausting one as well. Yeah. I would walk into a classroom and sometimes I'd go up to the front and start lecturing, and sometimes I'd go sit in the back and take notes and hope I didn't get called on.
Well, hopefully you did really well. I'm sure you did really well in law school. I'm going to get back to some of the programs you're involved in. I know that you teach at a local prison at Jessup here in Maryland, and I know that you also have the Prison and Justice Initiative, which I also want to talk about later. But I want to ask you, what prompted you in 2008 to go to law school?
It's very clear. I mean, I could give other justifications that I gave a little bit in general, which is I'd always been interested in the law, and in order to understand politics, you need to understand the legal dimension. But the real issue, the real cause was a personal one, which involved my childhood friend, Marty Tankliff, who was wrongfully convicted and spent 17 and a half years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. I've known Marty since the age of 3. I was the editor of our high school newspaper. This happened on the first day of our senior year of high school. I covered the case for our paper called The Purple Parrot, which is actually the only newspaper in New York or nationally that actually got the story right, it turns out. And I believed in his innocence. And over the years, although we drifted apart for a little while, and as we say, Marty went to jail and I went to Yale, but then we reconnected about a decade into his sentence and became very, very close. And I started to visit him. And it really was a transformative thing because Marty's an extraordinary individual. And once we started that new friendship, I decided I could never let go, and I would do anything I could to help him, both to get out and then eventually when he would get out. And it turns out that he got out just before I started law school. So in a sense, I could have said, okay, I'll stop now. It's mission accomplished. But by then, I'd become aware of so many of the problems in the criminal justice system that led to his wrongful conviction, but that also impacts so many other people. And that led me to go the full distance of getting my JD and becoming an attorney, even though I haven't practiced yet. I have that ability and I'm a member of the New York Bar.
Imagine being 17 years old and waking up one morning in your beautiful home and your beautiful life to find both of your parents brutally murdered. That's what happened to Marty Tankliff. On September 7th, 1988, Marty woke up to find his mother's body in her bedroom and his father's body in his office, both the victims of a terrible and bloody assault. He called for help, a panicked teenager. But almost immediately, the police decided that it was Marty who committed this horrible crime, and he even confessed to it. But guess what? He wasn't the killer. Unfortunately, it took 17 years to prove his innocence. And so, you know, we are really honored and excited that we are able to have Marty Tankliff with us also on today's episode. And I want to thank Mark for helping arrange that. But welcome to Undisclosed, Marty.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here today.
You know, your story is pretty remarkable, and I wasn't really aware of it until I met Mark, and then I started digging and doing some research. You were 17 years old at the time that your parents were killed, and you were arrested for this charge. So you were a juvenile at the time.
Yes.
Can I ask you, were you immediately imprisoned, or were you granted bail?
I was immediately imprisoned, and then after extensive litigation, probably about a month after I was arrested, bail was established, and I was released.
And you were released until the conviction, right?
Up until June 28th, 1990, when the jury returned a verdict of guilty, yes.
And you spent 18 years in prison, right?
6,338 days, to be exact.
Were you keeping track of the days while you were actually in prison, or is that something you went back and counted?
There was something called the lawyer's diary. And in the lawyer's diary, they have this condensed calendar. And every month, I would check off the days. And I actually still have that calendar to this day somewhere in my files.
Okay, so you were a juvenile at the time of this crime. Were you tried as a juvenile or as an adult?
I was tried as an adult.
Can one of you explain that? Because we see this over and over again. We see people who are clearly juveniles, but they're tried as adults. Why does this happen?
I know from, I think Mark and I can both say this, from going to law school, it differentiates from state to state, where in some states, certain crimes, even if you are a juvenile, you can be tried and prosecuted as an adult. But it really depends on what state or what jurisdiction you're in and the crime that you're charged with.
It's up to the discretion of the prosecutor how to charge. And so in particularly high profile cases that involve a violent crime, there's a very strong push for prosecutors to try the defendant as an adult, even at 17 or at 16, 15, 14. There are many cases of that as well, again, depending by state. But it's really up to the discretion of the prosecutor.
Would it be fair to say that there's maybe no state in the country where, like, this is statutorily not allowed? I mean, that a prosecutor cannot charge a juvenile as an adult? Like, does that even exist, or is that literally at their discretion?
I would hesitate to say that it's in every state. I don't know for a fact, but I think in the vast majority of states, it's very common for juveniles to be charged as adults. This is by no means an exceptional situation.
Oh, yeah. No, this is certainly something that we hear repeatedly, and definitely with violent crimes and more serious crimes. So, Marty, the thing about your case that is really fascinating is the evidence on which you were convicted. The bulk of the evidence really was your own confession. And can I mean, I don't know to what extent you can talk about that, but
I don't think, you know, when people say there was an extensive evidence, there really wasn't. There was absolutely zero evidence. There was no forensic evidence. There was no witness evidence. And the quote-unquote confession that was attributed to me was this claimed oral statement that law enforcement chose not to electronically record in any form or fashion. So for 20 years, it's kind of been a he said, she said. And this is one of the problems, and I've been trying to argue for 20 years, is that in Suffolk County, they actually had a policy and procedure whether in homicide cases and in cases where they were trying to extract a confession or a statement from suspects that they could have recorded. In my case, they chose to abandon the policy and procedure and kind of the common sense, which would be to record every word that was said in the interrogation room. This way, everyone's rights were protected. So what the jury was left with was this impression that I had confessed to law enforcement, because unfortunately, in 1990, jurors had a tendency, and they probably still do to this day, to have this trust and faith in law enforcement when they're testifying.
Probably the world's leading expert on false confessions, Richard Opshi, recently retired professor from UC Berkeley, has studied Marty's quote-unquote confession. And even under the terms most favorable to the prosecution and the police, he has analyzed the text and said that it's not only not evidence of Marty's guilt, that it's actually evidence of his innocence, because there's nothing in the narrative that actually matches anything in the crime scene. In other words, the person who gave the information that is in that sort of garbled text actually knew nothing about the crime.
Right.
So it's extraordinary.
Marty, just to back up, I have looked at like what was, you know, the basis of the conviction, and I agree with you. There was literally no evidence there. But the jury clearly, just like Adnan's case and many of the wrongful conviction cases, they accept certain things as evidence because the state has offered it, because law enforcement is offering it. I mean, it seems like from what I've read from just public coverage and stuff of the case that supposed confession like carried a lot of weight, not just with the jury, but also with the public. And I want to go back to what you said. The first day of your senior year in high school, this all happened. And I'm sure the students at the school heard that their friend, you know, their classmate, this guy they've known their whole lives, like confessed to this crime. Was that something that the students had heard about? And how did they react to that? How did you react to that?
So on the day it happened, what we heard in school after a couple hours of the school day was something happened to Marty's parents. And everybody's fear was, is Marty okay? And obviously hoping that his parents would be okay. But we learned that it was something really, really bad. And it turns out I actually had driver's ed that day and was for the first time behind the wheel of a car. And we were going around different areas. And the driver's ed teacher, who had had Marty in driver's ed over the summer, was incredibly concerned about Marty. And we actually drove by the house and saw the crime scene, saw the yellow tape out in front. And we realized, wow, it was something really bad. But never did anyone think for a second that Marty was somehow involved in it. So by nightfall, when the news is coming out that Marty's under arrest and that he has, quote unquote, confessed, it was utterly shocking. And then that led to a period of a lot of people, a lot of kids, you know, we were kids, we were 17, just being utterly confused and talking about it. And then, you know, many people saying, well, if he confessed, he must have did it. Innocent people don't confess. That's still the norm that most people believe. But it's been proven by countless cases of wrongful conviction due to false confession that is completely false. And I think that many of us were able, people who knew Marty and people who were looking into the case, and there's a whole other story involving the people who actually did commit the murders, and the incredible motive that Marty's father's business partner had.
Right.
An opportunity at 3:30 in the morning to be the last person to leave the poker game that was held at the house. But Marty was sound asleep in a faraway part of the house. So there are many, many aspects to this that became part of the conversation amongst the student body. But while I can't say it was unanimous that everybody thought Marty was innocent, there was a strong core of people who did. And then those who didn't would just say, well, why did he confess? And they wouldn't look beyond
right.
that.
So there's two things in this that I want to unpack. The first, of course, is this whole phenomena of false confessions. And I know, Marty, you do a lot of speaking on this issue. I mean, obviously, you've experienced this firsthand. Can you explain to people who don't understand, like, why would an innocent person confess or implicate themselves in any way? How does this happen? And what are the red flags to look for in these types of police interrogations that can signal that something is not right here?
One of the problems most people have is this inherent disbelief that anyone would admit to something they didn't do, especially a crime. So I was told by several experts that you need to break this down in the most simplistic form. So when I give speeches, I try to, you know, I ask the question, how many people have siblings? And, you know, half the people raised their hands. I said, well, remember back when you were children and you and your brother, your sister were home alone, somebody broke a lamp. Your parents come home and they say, we're not going out for ice cream till we find out who broke the lamp. And then I say, how many of you who didn't break the lamp admit that they broke the lamp? At least 50% of the people say, I did.
Yeah.
And I turn around and I say, you just confessed to a crime. You just confessed to something you didn't do. Then I say, enhance that by 1,000 times where you're older, you're isolated, you're sensory deprived, food deprived, physically threatened, verbally threatened, mentally tortured, isolated from family and friends. You are complete in a disassociated state at times. You are led to believe that you committed a crime when you know you didn't. You are told, just tell us what we want to hear and we'll let you go. There are so many red flags. And the problem is that those red flags can really be identified if law enforcement would do one very simple thing, and that is electronically record the interview and the interrogation, not the simple last 5 minutes after they've browbeat you for 10 or 15 hours and they get this confession. It's one of the reasons why I've actually pushed for legislation in New York is because in cases where we have videotape evidence of the entire interview and interrogation and confession, you have experts like Saul Kasson, Professor Richard Offshee, Steve Drizin, and so many others can really analyze what took place. And, you know, people need to understand this happens often. I believe out of the 341 DNA exonerations that the Innocence Project have achieved, probably almost 35 or 40% of those cases were false confessions.
So have you, as you are like lobbying for legislative changes on these issues, are you seeing pushback from the law enforcement community?
The interesting thing is that about maybe 2 years ago, I spoke at the NYPD and there was a police chief from down south somewhere where he told me a story where his department had a pushback initially. And after the program where they recorded every interview and interrogation, there was a 99.9% favor rating. So you do get a pushback initially, but nationally, law enforcement like this policy because it protects everyone involved.
Right.
It eliminates the accusations of physical abuse, mental abuse, suggestibility that takes place, and we really get to see what took place during that entire interrogation. Quite often, law enforcement says it's just an interview. It really isn't. When you get to the heart of it, if they bring somebody in, they are not looking for an interview. Interviews are not conducted in windowless rooms where there's very little furniture, where if you get beat up, nobody can hear you. Those are interrogation rooms.
Right.
You know, they're designed for people to be brought in there and not leave that room until law enforcement has what they want.
As you were listing the different reasons that these, you know, false confessions can take place, one thing that I was thinking was like, you know, what about the shock of what just actually happened to you? And when I was just watching some of the video footage and watching the trial footage of your case, I saw over and over again people say things like, well, he didn't have any emotional affect. Like he wasn't crying. And I was thinking, this is a 17-year-old who just lost his parents. And so you're in this interrogation situation and you've just lost your parents as a kid.
It was used as part of the case. It was more so used as a public ploy, but we actually had Dr. Herbert Spiegel, who at that point was probably the leading PTSD expert, come in and try to explain how individuals, after they have either directly witnessed a traumatic event or been involved in a traumatic event, can enter kind of a trance-like state or kind of a dissociative state where there's no affect, there's no emotion, there's just kind of this blank stare where they almost function like a robot. And you see this in a lot of cases. I mean, he told the story to the jury where how he got interested in this field. I forget what war. He was in the military, and a friend of his walked back with a leg or an arm of a soldier and just sat down in the tent and said, "Here's soldier," whatever his name was. And he was absolutely, completely normal. And from that point forward, he said he needs to understand the human brain, the human mind. And you see this in a lot of cases where people who are involved in very traumatic events, you almost become, it's a functioning nightmare or a functioning dissociative state where you can walk around, function normally. But it's almost like you hear the worst news and the ground underneath of you has just collapsed and you just exist. There's really not a functioning. You don't understand what's going on around you, really.
The footage that I saw you, to me, and it could be because I have an 18-year-old and I'm looking at you as a child in that footage, you just seemed shell-shocked.
Anybody who has listened to the 911 phone call, which is online somewhere, that is the clearest demonstration.
I heard it, yeah.
It's emotional. So anybody who says Marty's not emotional, you know, the people who know me best, know how sometimes I was brought up kind of emotions play kind of a backdoor role when things are important, because if you become emotional, you lose focus. I mean, that day was a completely different type of situation. But I think, you know, anybody listens to the 911 phone call, I think that speaks louder than anything that anybody else can say.
All right, hold on and I'll connect you.
He's gushing blood from the back of his neck. He's got a cut.
What happened to him?
I don't know. I just woke up and he's in the office. He's gushing blood.
Completely agree with Marty. This was a public relations ploy. This was a way of trying to say this was somehow a cold, vindictive, remorseless killer. But the thing is, they make the argument in the reverse direction. Someone shows too much emotion. Oh, that looks suspicious. It's not genuine. The truth is that emotions span a spectrum across people, and I'm sure all of us can think of different people who are on different ends of that spectrum. And Marty's not somebody who publicly shows emotion on a regular basis. We saw this through his 17 and a half years in prison, when there were these incredible setbacks that had the rest of us in shambles with 19 different appeals that were denied, and wow, some of them very, very close.
I'll just kind of give you the very brief rundown. So you have trial, conviction, you have appeal to the appellate division in New York State, appeal to the New York State Court of Appeals, federal habeas corpus, Second Circuit, Supreme Court, going back to the New York State Court of Appeals, going back to federal court, going back to trial courts. I mean, my case kind of went up to the Supreme Court and back down.
And there hearings.
And hearings. And I mean,
appeals on hearings. Ruling.
Appeals on hearings, oral arguments. I mean, we had one hearing where the judge's sole responsibility was to assess the credibility of the prosecutor in my case.
Oh, wow.
And at that hearing, the prosecutor's office nor the judge ever disclosed that the judge's daughter was working for the prosecutor who was testifying. So the judge had to assess the credibility of his daughter's boss at that hearing, and neither the judge nor the prosecutor's office ever disclosed that relationship. And when we finally found out about it, which was about 6 months later, we said, how is this a fair hearing?
Right.
Anybody who's been following Suffolk County and the corruption and scandals, those who've been victimized by Suffolk County have been raising these issues for 20 years, 30 years. And it's an epidemic that's not isolated to Suffolk County. Just Suffolk County has had the ability to cover up a lot of the scandal over the years.
And so there were questions of prosecutorial misconduct then in the case, too.
It was actually a Batson hearing. Batson hearing is we had a jury selection problem. We raised this issue throughout the state courts. None of the state courts wanted to address it. We finally brought it into the federal courts, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals absolutely agreed that there was an issue. However, the record really wasn't clear, so they remanded the case back down. And during that remand hearing, the judge's sole responsibility to assess the credibility of the prosecutor in my case.
I wanted to ask you, Mark, about something. I actually watched your clip on Oprah Winfrey, but you talked about coverage of criminal cases by the media. I think in that clip, you talked about how the media in general does like a really poor job of covering what's really happening in a case, whereas like you still had like a higher level of scrutiny and analysis on the case than just like the average media. How do you feel about like media coverage? How much do you think that impacts like, you know, what actually happens inside a courtroom?
So there's sort of a groupthink that starts to take place. And particularly, I think it's even worse now as there's this rush for the headlines and there's this, you know, 24-hour news cycle. There's this rush to be more sensationalist than your competitor. And that moves away from careful thinking about the facts, going against the grain. Everybody's rushing in the same direction. And that direction is sensationalized coverage, usually pointing towards a guilty party in a very premature fashion. And you know, there's sort of a public hysteria that takes place, and the news media both covers it and feeds it, fuels it. And I think that it's a serious problem in our criminal justice system is the way in which the media works with law enforcement, because that's who their sources are, their tips. They're the people they go to find out what's happening in a particular case. And it leads to mainstream media largely being the PR instrument of law enforcement. And that might be good in some cases where they've got the right person and it all works well. But what about when it doesn't? And that leads to a lot of errors, clearly in Marty's case, and I believe also in Adnan's case.
You know, one of the complications on these issues is the fact that most criminal defense attorneys just keep mum. They don't want clients to talk. They don't want to talk to media. And this is just traditionally how criminal defense is practiced.
Actually starting to change. And I think what we've seen over the last few years, and Lonnie Sori of Sori Communications in New York City, he was a public relations individual who got involved in my case. And he actually has done continuing legal education on educating lawyers how to take advantage of utilizing the media in criminal cases, because he's worked in this field for 20 years, and he said the prosecutor's office has their own public relations people. Why shouldn't defense lawyers?
Right.
And he was accused at one time of, quote-unquote, tampering with the jury pool. And he turned around and he goes, it's not tampering with the jury pool, it's educating society of the truth of a case. Or educating society about prosecutorial misconduct or forensic misconduct. And really what a lot of defense lawyers are starting to do now is they are starting to utilize the media. If you notice in the last 5-10 years, you're seeing more shows like 48 Hours, Dateline NBC, that are starting to cover wrongful conviction cases. And they're not just covering it once and leaving it alone. They're doing follow-up reports. And especially with social media, right, they have the ability to kind of expand spreading the word and educating people.
This is a shift that I certainly welcome, and I'm also a big advocate of social media. I think how Kathleen Zellner is handling the Avery case is pretty fascinating to watch. Have you guys been following her tweets on it?
Yes. If you think about what Making a Murderer has done, okay, just like Serial, we have started a conversation in society that for so many years people didn't want to talk about. We had this inherent belief the criminal justice system functioned and functioned well. And it wasn't until the mid-1990s when we started seeing one exoneration after another utilizing DNA that people start to realize there's a problem here. And I kind of had that issue when my post-conviction hearing started. I kind of said to one of the reporters, I said, where have you been? Mm. And their answer was, we failed in our job. They said, we failed to challenge what we were being told. We accepted whatever prosecutors were telling them, law enforcement were telling them. And I think as the exoneration started to develop, more people in the media, more reporters started going back to, I guess you would say, investigative journalism.
Right.
And that really has benefited the criminal justice system, because now you have reporters helping to uncover wrongful convictions, misconduct, and there have been some reporters that have essentially helped lead to exonerations. Now, I look at my case, 48 Hours did 6 shows on my case, Erin Moriarty, Gail Zimmerman, Susan Zirinsky, I had Bill Curtis do American Justice.
Were these all shows that were done while you were incarcerated?
Majority of them were, yeah.
Well, let me just back up just a little bit. So you were convicted. How were you sentenced?
50 years to life. So if I was not exonerated, my initial parole board would have been, I believe it was October of 2040. So another 24 years.
Right, right. I think there's been some coverage in the New York Times about like parolees and what they've had to go through, how many times they have to appear over and over again, and they have to show remorse, and it's just horrible.
Yeah, and if you're innocent, you don't show remorse because you didn't actually commit the crime, then you're denied parole. I mean, it's this really sort of twisted logic.
A one-minute story. There was a case in New York, which Mark and I know about, David McCallum. David McCallum was an individual who was proclaiming his innocence in New York, kept appearing before the parole board, kept proclaiming his innocence, kept being denied parole. I heard about this through Oscar Michelin, who's his lawyer, and some press reports, and I actually wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Law Journal saying that the parole board is punishing him, David McCallum, for exercising his rights. And I was one of the early individuals who actually took a public stance about this. And about a year and a half later, after that letter was published in the New York Law Journal, David McCallum was exonerated.
And the day he got out, he spent 4 hours on the phone with Marty, prepped him on all the things to expect coming out as an exoneree, because it's actually really difficult. And that's something hopefully you'll have the opportunity with Adnan to experience this, but it's not easy.
And that's actually something I wanted to ask you about. What was it that suddenly propelled all of these media outlets to start doing shows on your case? What happened?
I would say it has to be kind of a combination. I mean, it was Lonnie Story, Eric Friedman, and Roz Dan, who were all Story Communications, who took a interest in my case because of Jay Salpeter, who was a private investigator. And there were certain reporters, one of them in particular was Bruce Lambert of the New York Times. And it got to a point where a lot of people in the press, what I say is they got it. They finally understood the case. They understood a lot of the newly discovered evidence. Nobody was going to sweep this under the rug. I also had the ability to, as the case developed a little bit, to get some high-profile people who just lended their name to the case. James Gandolfini was one of them. But it really, even before he got involved, you started seeing reporters, and one of them in particular was Carolyn Gusoff. Carolyn Gusoff covered my case 25 years ago. She continued to cover my case. After my exoneration, she actually did a complete mea culpa. She wrote a public, essentially an apology, saying she failed in her job as a reporter. But what I tell people who work on these wrongful conviction cases is you need to embrace the media. You need to educate them. And if one person in the media turns their way, don't stop. Just keep pushing, because you will encounter someone in the media who gets it, who wants to be involved. And anybody who's ever been involved in a wrongful conviction case, as far as reporters go, it is a defining moment in their career that they will never regret. Mm-hmm. And it's something that it's one of their proudest moments. You know, all the reporters that were involved in my case, I'm pretty much staying in touch with majority of them. And they still say it was one of the proudest opportunities in their careers to kind of cover my case.
The end of the case, not necessarily the beginning.
Correct.
The end of it.
Correct. The end of it. Yeah. There was a reporter who actually worked for News 12, and probably about 10 years before I got exonerated, he covered my case. I stay in touch with him now, and I said to him, I said, Matt, when you covered the case, did you ever believe I was going to be exonerated? He goes, no, Mark, because I had a feeling the system would fail you.
Wow.
And that is the kind of the philosophy that a lot of reporters had in that mid-1990s, when innocent people in prison, nobody believed that.
Right.
Those didn't exist.
Well, can we talk about your exoneration? Because our listeners are going to want to know, how were you exonerated?
Sure. We had litigated throughout New York State and the feds, and it got to a point where my lawyers, who were Steve Braga, Barry Pollack, Kirsten Levinson, Jennifer O'Connor, Roberto Gonzalez, all these amazing lawyers. And they said, you know, what's never been done from the very beginning? And they said, an investigation. So I went on an effort to find a private investigator who was willing to work on my case. And I had very, very little funds. So I had to find somebody who wanted to do this, knew what it would entail. Retired NYPD detective Jay Salpeter, who offered to work the case. I had to give him $5,000. But his first question to me was, if you're innocent, hire me. I'll work to get you out. If you're guilty, don't waste both of our times. I said, where do I sign? Mm-hmm. And what Jay did was, is Jay went back from the very beginning. He looked at my father's business partner who owed my father over $500,000. Jerry Sturman's son, Todd, was a drug dealer who had enforcers. And all of a sudden, Jay just started breaking down the relationships with everybody. And he ended up settling on a man by the name of Glenn Harris. He visited Glenn Harris, and the first thing Glenn Harris said, he goes, "I've been waiting 12 years for this day to come."
Wow.
And Jay said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "I was the getaway driver that night." And that just started the what I would call the domino effect of leading from one witness to another witness to another witness.
Wow.
Which ended up leading us to post-conviction hearings in Suffolk County. And Joseph Creedon was one of the individuals we identified and others identified as being the murderer. His own son was our last witness, and his own son testified that his father admitted his involvement and confessed to him. In Suffolk County fashion, the trial judge ruled against me, and it was only fortuitous because the appellate division judges, in their ultimate wisdom, saw the truth, saw the facts, and they reversed my conviction in 2007, made Mark fly back from France to be there for my release. Very short days after I was released, the Suffolk County District Attorney had announced they were going to dismiss the indictments against me. Unfortunately, there were some backdoor deals going on, and the former illustrious Elliot Spitzer was appointed as a special prosecutor before the District Attorney's office had the opportunity to dismiss the indictments. The Attorney General of the State of New York conducted their own independent investigation, and in the summer of 2008, all charges were dismissed. And since then, we have continued to investigate the case, and I can tell you about one piece of newly discovered evidence which was disclosed through the discovery process. Mm-hmm. Earlier on, you talked about evidence and what was presented to the jury and the public. The watermelon knife was a knife that was in my home sitting next to a piece of watermelon. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutor presented publicly and to the jury that the watermelon knife was the murder weapon.
Right.
And during my civil discovery, we actually had the opportunity to depose the medical examiner who admitted, he said, 25 years ago, I told everybody in the DA's office it was not the murder weapon and could not have been the murder weapon. So he had a fact that was undisclosed to everybody, and this was really a huge piece of evidence because this was disclosed as being the murder weapon,
right?
And the pink substance on the knife was watermelon.
When I'm listening to this, it's become so familiar to me. It's heartbreaking no matter how many times you hear it, though. The fact that, you know, the trial judge is being presented with witness who's saying, hello, my father admitted to doing this. He still doesn't rule for you. What is up with the system that fights the exoneration attempts, fights to keep their convictions at all costs?
I think there are two things going on. First, you have some people who are malicious and who want to close a case because of their own political interests. They don't care if they have the right person or not. They think the person, you know, deserves some punishment. A lot of times in wrongful conviction case, they pick somebody up who had committed other crimes and they say, oh, well, might as well just pin it on this one. I think that's probably a small number of police and prosecutors who are quite that malicious that they're literally pinning on people. But they're out there and they've done it a number of times, often repeatedly. But I think what really tends to happen is that there's this tunnel vision that takes place where they fixate on somebody. And then they convince themselves that that is the person. And they genuinely believe it. And then what happens is that whenever there's disconfirming evidence, whenever some witness is actually saying the opposite of what they thought the person would say, or there's a new piece of evidence that comes out, like Marty just mentioned about the knife, then they tune it out. They don't pay attention to it. And they focus in and they give excessive weight to something that is extremely minor. And so there were ridiculous things in Marty's case that they brought. They brought a car mechanic to testify at trial that Marty had had an argument with his father about a car, about a crummy old Lincoln. Supposedly Marty had said, I don't want to drive a crummy old Lincoln. And they brought that as evidence that somehow there were these problems between Marty and his father and that somehow showed that he was willing to kill his father. I mean, just utterly ridiculous stuff. But they focus on the things that they think will work for them. And I think they do it in a way that, again, for some is malicious where they just want to pin it on somebody. But for many, I think it's a human nature way of, you know, trying to confirm what you believe. And then once they have that, especially once they get a conviction, then it's at all costs. They view it as undermining their entire office, their institution, their career, their life to say they made a mistake. that's the real problem. That's where you're stuck right now in Adnan's case. And Marty was stuck there for, you know, almost two decades. Even when it's totally obvious that they made a mistake, law enforcement community is afraid to admit it. That's shameful.
What one of my lawyers calls it is institutional blinders. Mm-hmm. And that is where law enforcement settles their sights on one individual, and all they do is focus their attention on that one individual and manufacture, develop, or look for any evidence on that one person and that one person only. And quite often, because of the relationship with law enforcement and the prosecutor's office doesn't challenge anything. They just accept whatever's handed to them and they work with it. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why in New York, the governor recently signed an executive order where in officer-involved shootings, the attorney general's office prosecutes those cases. And that was because there was a claim that the relationship between the district attorneys and law enforcement are too close.
Mm. Do you think the attorney general's office is far enough away? I feel like even judges aren't far enough away. I don't even...
Well, I mean, in New York, it's the best system possible right now. If you have an officer-involved shooting in Suffolk County, having somebody in Albany looking into the case is much better than having the Suffolk County DA's office looking to it, knowing the relationship. If you want, I will forward you an article that was in Newsday about a Suffolk County prosecutor who owns a boat who would rent it out to defense lawyers that were appearing before judges in Suffolk County on cases he was working on.
That's egregious.
It is so egregious. And one of the lawyers said, you know, who was I supposed to report this to when judges in Suffolk County were on the boat and the prosecutor was on the boat?
I want to ask just one last question. Marty, I want to ask you, can you tell us a little bit about your organization, Absolute Innocence, what you guys do and what the public can do to support you?
Sure. Absolutely Innocent is what I call a new innocence project that seeks to assist in the exoneration of individuals who are wrongfully incarcerated. But what we're also looking to do is create an education program and a transition program for people who are getting out. I know that I struggled upon my release, and I know other exonerees that struggle upon it. I mean, people can donate financially directly through the website. And I tell people one of the easiest ways to donate is if you go to smile.amazon.com, you can choose Absolutely Innocent as your designated program. The problem is that there is not enough resources, there's not enough individuals who have the time or the ability to work on wrongful conviction cases. These cases are thousands of hours of work,
right,
and in some cases, millions of dollars in billable hours and expenses. So one of the goals that our Absolutely Innocent is trying to do is kind of be that initial group that gets to look at a case, see if there's something there that can be investigated, can be forensically tested, and then work with a network of lawyers and investigation experts to try to get people involved to work on these cases. The Innocence Project in New York City focuses on DNA cases. What I say is those are the easy cases because if there's a biological evidence that can be tested, you test it, you move forward.
Right.
It's the cases that have been exonerated in Brooklyn, New York, where DA Ken Thompson has, I think he's up to number 20. And a majority of those exonerations, it was really a reinvestigation.
You're right. I mean, that's been one of the frustrations also with Adnan's case. There wasn't a DNA that could have helped him. Like, at least we didn't think there was. And so he just was a dead end with the Innocence Project. So this is a huge undertaking. And we'll definitely share the website and I'll tweet it out and all that, too, with our listeners.
One of the things that I think a lot of people are failing to kind of explore is the utilization of polygraph examinations. In New York State, the test results of polygraph examinations are admissible in post-conviction proceedings as a piece of evidence, not for the truth of it. They're also admissible in family court proceedings. They're admissible in pretrial hearings. There's a polygraph examiner that I'm friendly with in New York who is offered to do free polygraph examinations in any wrongful conviction cases. He was just appointed by a federal judge in a custody dispute where he was ordered to test the mother and the father. So it is something that is starting to be utilized a little bit more in wrongful conviction cases, probably not enough because some people have a disbelief that they're not accurate. Right. But I tell people that if administered properly under the right set of circumstances, they are very reliable. A lot of law enforcement agencies, you must pass a polygraph to be hired. And other agencies, you take regular polygraphs to see if you're on the straight and narrow. So for people to say that they're not reliable, if they weren't reliable, you wouldn't need to pass one to get employment, and you wouldn't need to pass them to stick with law enforcement.
Well, that's an amazing, offering that you have a contact who would do free polygraphs for potential wrongful convictions in New York. So if there's anybody out there who think it could be helpful to their loved ones, I hope they do reach out to you. Mark, I would love to follow up with you another time. Maybe we could have you back, because I really do want to talk about reentry issues, education issues, the work you're doing inside Jessup Prison. Unfortunately, we can't get to that today, but I want to thank both of you so very much for joining me for this interview. Tweet at us, Undisclosed, so our listeners can see the work you're doing, the events you're having, and how we can continue to support you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, Susan and I had the chance to speak to Brooke Giddings. Brooke is a licensed social worker, a therapist, and the host of the Actual Innocence podcast. The Actual Innocence podcast consists of Brooke's one-on-one interviews with the wrongfully convicted. She talks to them about their lives before they were convicted, their experiences with the legal system, their time in prison, and how they've readjusted to the outside world since being released. I've had the chance to listen to each of the episodes, and I think it really gives a great new perspective on many of the issues we've discussed so far on Undisclosed. You can download the Actual Innocence podcast by going to audioboom.com/channel/actualinnocence. Here's our interview with Brooke.
When did you get started with a podcast? Like, when did you start, and why did you?
Well, I have actually two podcasts. The other one has closed. What made me start with that one? It was kind of based on Making a Murderer, and I work as a therapist, and surprisingly, most therapists are social workers. So when I was in social worker school, they basically said, it's your job to advocate for people who can't advocate for themselves. And so when one of my friends at work, another therapist, saw Making a Murderer, we were both kind of outraged because we had both our entire lives saw law enforcement and courts as being, you know, on our side. And we're like, wow, that's not how it worked. So we decided that we were going to do, you know, a podcast based on that Making a Murderer theme and help promote social justice. And during that, we met up with someone who was worked for the Michigan Innocence Clinic, which is part of the Greater Innocence Project. And he was really insightful, and he connected me with several exonerees. And I thought, you know, this would be a great podcast in itself to tell the story of these people. So people kind of get their, you know, satisfying ending, but also see where the criminal justice system has so many faults that need to be looked at.
Yeah, and one of the cases that the Michigan Innocence Clinic handled was Julie Baumer, and that's one of the episodes that you've done so far, and it actually ties into some of the themes I was discussing a couple episodes ago. So can you tell me about the Julie Baumer case and what happened there?
Yeah, Julie was my very first interview, so I was very nervous, but she was great. I actually disclaimered at the beginning of my call with her that I get really nervous and I talk over people, so to not let me. And she was like, I do the same thing. And then, so from that minute on, it felt like a very comfortable interview. But what happened was, when Julie was in her mid-20s, her sister was raped and got pregnant. And Julie, being the person she is, had agreed with her family and her sister to do an in-family adoption of her nephew, Philip. And so when Philip was born, he was in the ICU for infants for a long period of time. And his sister said it was because he had acid reflux. Because the adoption hadn't went through yet, the hospital was still dealing directly with the sister. And finally, she gets to take Philip home with her, her nephew, who she's adopting as her son. And she has this feeding schedule that he's supposed to do. And basically, she has to feed him every 2 hours. So she says one, I believe it was a Thursday, one Thursday, she's taking him to these baptism classes. And the pastor, the priest, says to her, you know, he doesn't look so good. And she hadn't noticed. Well, when she gets home that night, she notices that he's not eating. And so after an entire night of not eating, she decides to call the pediatrician. And so she calls the pediatrician and they say, you know, take him to the ER. And they take him to the ER and he's then transferred to a children's hospital. Well, a couple of days of after being in the children's hospital, a nurse measures his head, which I guess is routine for an infant. And his head has grown tremendously. And after they examine him, they see that they have bleeding behind his retinas and kind of brain damage, more or less. And they diagnose it as shaken baby syndrome. And Julie is arrested for that and later convicted.
It turns out that, in fact, the child suffered from what's known as, I guess, a childhood stroke. And eventually she, through that in the Michigan Innocence Clinic, is able to secure her release.
Right, exactly. He did end up having a stroke. And part of the tragic part is when you hear Julie say that, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. He had a stroke and they still legally kidnapped because Philip lived. So they still legally kidnapped Philip and she never got her son back.
Yeah, and I think really one of the great virtues of your podcast was illustrated in talking to Julie Bomber, and that was talking about how while she's been released and exonerated, she still years later feels the impact in her life. And we often hear these stories in the news, like Malcolm Bryant just exonerated in Baltimore. But I think the great thing in talking to her on the podcast is it really shows beyond that the reverberations that this continues to have in a person's life.
She had a more fire in her, more anger, maybe? I don't know if that's the right word to use, but more so than a lot of the others I've talked to and heard of and heard from.
It's true. I've done several interviews of exonerees at this point, and Julie seemed very, I don't want to say angry, but she seemed like she had lost her son. This is what bothered me about Julie's case the most personally, was that, you know, she had done this great thing. She had adopted her son who wasn't wanted, you know, who had been the product of a rape and might otherwise have been not born. And then this terrible thing happens to her because of it. And when it comes out that she hadn't done anything wrong, she still doesn't have custody of her son. So her life has been changed forever by this child, just not in the way that she expected it.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was connected, as in, from my perspective, obviously I can't identify with it, I can't understand how, but a lot of them managed to forgive the circumstances that led to where they were wrongly incarcerated. But I wonder if her still apparent anger has to do more with the loss of the son, which could never be fixed.
She also, it wasn't in the podcast, and it'll probably be in an upcoming bonus. She had a nephew that she was co-raising with her mother that was the brother of Philip. And he also, after that point, after Julie went to jail, kind of stopped functioning or started functioning in a lower level and didn't really reach what she thought was his full potential.
Obviously, now you're interviewing these exonerees and dealing with these situations where sometimes families are torn apart, and I wonder how that compares or contrasts with your day-to-day job as a therapist and social worker and dealing with these types of situations.
It's very similar. When you're a social worker, your first 2 years of being a social worker, you can only accept Medicaid clients in a private practice. So the population that I work with right now are underprivileged, low-income populations. I see a lot of single mothers. I see a lot of people. If this had happened to them, they wouldn't have been able to retain an attorney the way Julie did. They wouldn't have the means to really help themselves. And I see kids who, you know, probably had shaken baby syndrome when they were younger, or maybe they had a stroke, or they have some kind of cognitive delay. And I can't imagine those parents having intentionally given that kind of injury to a child.
I don't know if you listened to our last episode of Undisclosed when Colin interviewed Karen Daniel, but one of the things she was talking about was how for women who were exonerated, there was a much higher percentage of them who were convicted of crimes that were never crimes in the first place. And Julia's case fit in very well with that paradigm. So regard with Julia's case, they said that between, 24 and 48 hours before the baby was admitted to the hospitals when the injury occurred?
Right.
That's a long time frame.
And the baby was admitted to the ER at one point and then transferred to another hospital. And the next day was when they had done the measurement of his head. So actually, the Innocence Project discovered that at the time that he would have been shaken, you can't see my air quotes, that he was actually in the ER. He was in the care of the other hospital before the children's hospital.
I hate to call this a chain of custody issue, but in terms of showing evidence that even if there was actually injury inflicted by an outside actor, how could they narrow that down to Julie?
Well, and they had just said it was because she was the primary caregiver, and that was probably the reason in the original trial. But yeah, at the second hearing, they did point that out, that, wow, he was actually in the custody of professionals at that time.
Yeah, and I wonder, Brooke, Julie, like so many defendants, don't end up testifying at trial. And when you reach out to someone like Julie or a Greg Taylor, what's their responsiveness in terms of, is this something where they're really eager to tell their side of the story and explain what happened and their experiences? Or what have you experienced in talking to some of these exonerees?
Yeah, I think that Julie's attorney picked up on the same thing that we all picked up from Julie, that she had that internal aggression going on. She told me that she wanted to testify, but her attorney told her that if her voice went up one octave during that testimony, that they would think she was guilty. So he told her not to testify, even though that was her choice. So that was the reason she did not.
That attorney sounded like he made a lot of mistakes and did not give her the representation she needed. But I find it hard to disagree with that call, at least from what I've seen and know about the case. I think that was probably the right thing to do.
Right, and not being attorney, I'm not really sure how that works, but that's what a few of the people that I have spoken with have told me, that their attorneys did not want them to take the stand because they felt that they were very passionate about their case and they didn't want them to come off as defensive.
And there's mixed perspectives on this. People with different approaches to whether or not they're more inclined to let, you know, the defendant testify, or if they're in certain cases, whether it's a good idea to let them do it. And it's probably one of those things you can never really determine in advance, and in hindsight, it's 2020 and all that. But I've seen people who are exonerated who did testify, and the fact they testified seems to have contributed to it, to the conviction, because of it gives the prosecution a chance to cause all kinds of mayhem against your case. And then others who don't testify, who feel like if they'd gotten to tell their side of the story, well, then they wouldn't have gotten convicted. That's not a simple question that can really be answered definitively in any case, I don't think.
Well, and the story with Greg has so many attorney mishaps. I felt terrible for him.
Oh, yeah.
Greg actually contacted me. My contact at the Innocence Project had sent out my information on this listserv that he's a member of, and Greg had contacted me directly. And Greg's second attorney, he went through two attorneys for his first trial, but his second attorney had a no defense defense. And I'm not an attorney, but that doesn't sound like a very good defense to me.
That's not a thing.
Right, good. And so Greg had told me that his attorney didn't do anything. Like, his second attorney didn't have any evidence because he said that it was the prosecution's job to convict him, and they didn't have enough evidence. And so he didn't need to testify, he didn't need to do anything, because the most important thing was for Greg's defense attorney to have his closing argument be the first, because he was going to argue that they hadn't proven his case, and that was going to be enough.
I don't understand anything about that logic. I mean, he described it in that episode, and I couldn't follow. Maybe it's nothing there to follow in the first place, because it made no sense to me.
Right, and he said that the weekend before he delivered the closing argument, he was giving a speech at a law school, and he said, my wife and I both thought that the closing argument that my whole life rested on sounded suspiciously like a speech that someone might give at a law school.
To be generous to the attorney, the best I can think of is that he saw the case was so nothing, so air and hand-waving, that he thought that there's no way he can get convicted, and therefore I'm okay with phoning it in. maybe? That's the only explanation I can come up with.
Right. Well, and Greg's original attorney had been his attorney for almost a year, and he was sending him the money, and he would give him calls, and he wouldn't return his calls. And eventually that attorney went away for not doing anything for fraud, because he had done that with so many of his clients that his original attorney is now in prison for fraud.
There was a line from someone with the North Carolina crime lab talking about what they did for testing. And so in his case, there was a presumptive test for blood, which prosecution argued at trial was proof that he'd been the killer involved in the killing, because that's how the victim's blood got in his car. And of course, it turns out they tested it for blood and it came back negative, but that wasn't recorded. And the crime lab tech, or I don't even know their title, said, well, that was our policy not to record negative results.
Yeah, this was one of the most tragic parts of Greg's case. They found a red spot on his truck that was, he said, less than the size of a fingernail. And in the original trial, they had done two types of confirmatory testing on this spot, and they actually realized that it was not blood and it was not human blood. But it was their policy to not report negative findings at the trial. The only kind of findings that they would report were the ones that helped the prosecution. And so the jury had been told that the substance reacted like blood. And, you know, if I were on a jury and I hear, oh, you know, a substance that reacted like blood was on his car, I'm going to assume it's blood. And that was one of the big things that had been part of the reason why he was convicted, was because her blood was on his car. Well, 10 years later, when other attorneys are looking through the evidence, they find that it wasn't blood, and the crime lab knew about it the entire time.
In our season 2 case, there's almost an exact parallel, different kind of testing, but there's a conclusion saying we found XYZ case, but no details whatsoever concerning why that conclusion was reached, what the basis was, what the factual predicate was. It's just a conclusion, full stop. And I was talking to some people from the crime lab about that, and they said that was their policy to make things easier for the prosecution, was to not give details they could be challenged on. And that was the policy.
If you listen to the bonus episode, Greg actually tells kind of his little, I think, revenge story on this crime lab. But actually, the crime lab changed its name and a new policy was put into place to make sure that that doesn't happen anymore. So not only, you know, was Greg exonerated, but his case actually changed policy to make sure that this doesn't happen as often.
Yeah, I mean, the Greg Taylor case, I think, is also a nice illustration of something that was brought up initially in Serial, which is, at the end of the day, you're looking at it and saying, well, how could one person be so unlucky? Well, in this case, Greg Taylor was very unlucky through a combination of things. His Nissan Pathfinder, right, it got stuck in the mud relatively close to a cul-de-sac where a young woman had been found murdered. And as you say, he had ineffective assistance. There was evidence withheld by the prosecution. And you actually did two full interview segments with him and then some bonus material. And what was it like talking to him about this whole sort of almost Kafka-esque experience that he had with the justice system?
It was so interesting. Greg is such a positive person. And I don't know that after spending 6,149 days, as he puts it, in prison, that I would be able to laugh and joke like Greg did. But he laughed a lot. Like, he was a very satisfied person. And so it was really hard for me to interview Greg because, you know, I was afraid to ask those tough questions. But he was very nice. We talked for like 2.5 hours. And a couple of times, you know, you hear him in tears because he's talking about the life events of his daughter that he missed out on. If you listen to the bonus episode, you hear him tell this fabulous story about his daughter's wedding. And Greg was just an overall, he seems like he's happy and satisfied with life. And I really have to give him credit for that, because I don't know, had I been in the same situation, that I would have been able to make the best of it. When he was in prison, he earned a couple college degrees in computer programming. He tells this great story about his glasses, or lack of. He has poor eyesight, and he can't see things that are very far away. And at one point, his dad comes to him and says, you know, Greg, you need to get some glasses, you can't see. And he said, but Dad, I can see things close enough for me to read, and things that are more than 6 feet away from me in this prison are none of my business.
That's a good perspective on things. I mean, that is the gist of the podcast, right? It is you on the phone talking with these people who've been exonerated, hearing their stories, their humor, their sadness, what they've gone through. And that's what listeners would plan to hear, right? Is these stories of these people who, for whatever reason or combination of reasons, found themselves behind bars for crimes they didn't commit.
Right. And there is such a diverse group of people who are telling these stories. You know, Greg is a middle-class white guy. That's how he puts it. I was a middle-class white guy who was wrongly convicted. And he said, if you look around at my fellow exonerees, they don't look like me, and they weren't in my same status. Greg retains an attorney. Julie retains an attorney. They were both white middle-class people. Derek Bunkley, who I also have an episode about, he had a public defender who also did a poor job. So when you look at all of the different kinds of people, it's not exclusive to those who are poor. It's not exclusive to those who are black, those who are white, those who are women.
Your podcast is a different style from a lot of them in that you have your guests, the exonerees, talking almost as if it was a monologue with you narrating at periods of it. How did you come about with that style?
My intention of my podcast is to help bring awareness of the issues in the criminal justice system. And I think people need to hear their stories from them. I think it's a much different effect if I were to tell the stories because I don't know them as well. But to have the actual people who are exonerated telling their stories, I think really, you know, makes them human and makes people see that these are real people's lives that are being affected by bad policies.
How do you find your guests?
I have a few connections with various Innocence Projects. I actually didn't understand when I first started that the Innocence Project isn't like one place. It's actually several clinics and offices that are connected through this Innocence Network.
Loosely connected.
Right. I have several connections at a few different Innocence Project locations who help me find the guests. And I don't know that I will do this, but I've had a few people contact me with people who are still incarcerated asking if I want to look into that case. So we'll see how that goes in the future.
How would you feel about a case where it is someone who is still incarcerated and they want to tell their story? How would that be different, and what would you feel in terms of conducting that if it were someone where they're trying to establish their innocence as opposed to someone explaining why they were found innocent?
I feel like I would have to do a lot more research because I am a therapist, I am a social worker, I'm not an attorney, that I would need to do a lot more research to understand the different legal things that have happened to them, because something I might feel is unjust might be legally okay, if that makes sense.
In your day-to-day life as a social worker and therapist, I imagine that at least collaterally, you end up discussing things of at least a quasi-legal nature with the people you're working with.
Yeah, we do a lot. So I am a child and family therapist. I work mostly with children. Several of my clients come from what in Indiana is called the Department of Children's Services. So these are children who have been removed from the homes of their parents. And when that happens, then, you know, usually the parents are given an assignment or like a procedure that they have to go through to have their children given back to them. And a lot of times it's through a family court process. And I don't know how to say this delicately, so I'm just going to say it. But, you know, a lot of times we disagree with what the judges say to these families. Like, you know, if this child has been working with me in therapy and I feel like it will be harmful for them to be reunited with their parents, I can say that to the court. I can say that to the judge. But they don't always listen. And so I guess I need to understand more the mechanics of where the judge is coming from to give this child back to this family that is obviously harmful from them. I mean, I work with children who have mental illnesses, behavior disorders, and a lot of trauma victims. And so to return a child who was traumatized by their previous living situation back into that living situation sometimes feels very scary to me, and I don't know where that legal decision comes from.
Do you have a plan for how long you're going to go with this series?
I have several interviews scheduled. There are a lot of exonerees to go around, but not everybody wants to talk about it, which I understand. I mean, that is a traumatizing experience. And so if someone doesn't feel comfortable, I'm not going to push them to tell their story. But I have a lot of interviews scheduled, and there are a lot of people who have been exonerated. And so I hope to keep going for as long as people are willing to tell their stories.
I want to thank Brooke for taking the time to talk to us today. Once again, her podcast is Actual Innocence. You can download it from audioboom.com/channel/actualinnocence. You can download it from her website, www.actualinpod.com. And her Twitter handle is @actualinpod.
Spent a lot of time in the last year looking at the many ways the criminal justice system is broken, how the young and disenfranchised are often at its mercy. There has definitely been a growing interest in criminal justice reform, thanks to the many stories that we've been told, whether it's over the TV, on social media, or through podcasts. It's catching the attention of not just ordinary citizens and the media, it's also getting the attention in the halls of power, of policymakers and politicians. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.